Have you ever longed to escape reality? Or fantasized about stepping into someone else's shoes, even for just a little while? Hi, I'm Laura Mullen.
And I'm Chris Tolley. We host CBC's Play Me, the immersive podcast that transforms theater into addictive audio fiction. Join us for a new season and disappear into a world rich with drama, where every show delivers hypnotizing stories and unveils intriguing characters with secrets.
Play Me, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
I'm Eleanor Wachtel, and this is Writers and Company from the Archives. Today, the British author of the popular Grantchester mystery series, James Runcie. His latest novel imagines the life of Johann Sebastian Bach through the year 1727 that he wrote the St. Matthew Passion. James Runcie was born in Cambridge, England in 1959. His father was a vicar who became the Archbishop of Canterbury. His mother, a concert pianist. If you mix the two together, it may not be that surprising that James would one day write an historical novel, envisioning the creation of perhaps the greatest work of liturgical music ever, Bach's St. Matthew Passion. I know it's not as simple or predetermined as all that. Along the way, James studied at Cambridge University and Bristol Old Vic Theatre School. He became a writer and director, a documentary filmmaker, an artistic director of literary festivals, and a visiting professor. He's also the author of a dozen novels, including seven books in his Grantchester Mysteries. These revolve around a young vicar, Sidney Chambers, who's also an amateur sleuth, buddies with the local detective. A veteran of the Second World War, he's charming, funny, energetic, and sexy. As Runcie once described the series, like the novels of Barbara Pym with no clothes on. This is especially true in the enormously popular television adaptation, now in its eighth season, where the at times brooding Anglican minister remains unmarried. James Runcie's latest novel stays with the Protestant Church, but is in every other way different. Set in Leipzig, Germany, The Great Passion is a fictionalized year in the life of Johann Sebastian Bach, mid-career, culminating with the writing and first performance of his St. Matthew Passion in 1727. Told through the eyes of an invented 13-year-old student, it conjures up the man behind the legendary composer, an ambitious working musician and father of eight, coping with grief and loss through faith and music. In this case, music emblematic of Easter. James Runcie lives in London and for part of the year near St. Andrews, Scotland, which is where he was when we spoke in 2022. The German composer Johann Sebastian Bach is a kind of obsession of yours, you've said. You made a documentary film about him, you wrote a play for the BBC, and now he's at the center of your new novel, The Great Passion. What is it about Bach that engages your imagination? Why do you keep coming back to him?
Because he's the not only the musical foundation to my life, but the spiritual foundation, the sacred foundation, all that's good about life. And I think there's something endlessly reassuring about his music. It is both able to convey some kind of mathematical purity, but also deep passion. And I don't know how he does it. And so my work is an investigation into how can you manage to be somehow so rational and yet so emotional at the same time.
I can see that would be a lifelong obsession because it is so unfathomable. But we'll explore it together a little bit. When did you first come across Bach's music?
I can't remember because it's almost as if it was always with me, because my mother was a piano teacher, so she would be playing Bach before I could speak. And she would play the well-tempered clavier as a way of sort of limbering up most mornings to playing and teaching. And my father was a priest, and so that Bach's music would be sung, and my mother sang in the Bach choir, my sister still does. And so he was kind of the composer. I mean, obviously, you know, there's Mozart and Beethoven, many, many other composers, but he was the foundation of our family, both religiously and musically.
You've admitted that it's perverse to write a novel about,
quoting... Oh, it's bonkers. It's absolutely bonkers.
Just to say, but I have to say, because I have to quote you, one of the greatest musicians who's ever lived, the voice of God in music. How did you get over that?
Well, it's a mixture of arrogance and stupidity, really. Also the wanting to find out. I mean, actually, it's not, that's a flippant answer. The serious answer is wanting to know how great art works and wanting to live with it and share it and feel it as part of your life, to feel it in the veins. But also I think there's something very important about practicing and rehearsals, that Bach was very, very keen on discipline and on knowing the foundations of music. He's such an inspiration that you want to sort of try to take away the voice of God in music, and you try to look at life, look at his life as a working musician, as a teacher. You try to break it down as much as possible into some kind of daily routine to work out what it was like not just to be the voice of God in music, but flesh and blood.
Yes, to stay with the working musician, Bach arrived in Leipzig in 1723, a few years after the death of his first wife and his remarriage, to take on the position of choirmaster or cantor at St. Thomas's Church and School. What did the job entail?
He was head of music in a school. So if you imagine a kind of well-funded, relatively well-funded private school known for its music, there are 55 boys, divided into four choirs of 12, so 48 with seven spare, depending on, you know, the illness and people coming and going. And his job was to run those four choirs and to run the music in the school. And also he was responsible for the music in three other churches, you know, weddings, funerals, anything to do with those things. And he has also eight town musicians at his disposal, you know, violinists and viola player and two trumpeters. And he obviously provides continuo and keyboard. But also he has to teach theology and Latin, which later, in later years, he delegates and gets into terrible trouble for sending in senior boys to take his lessons for him because he's too busy doing the music, or he just feels it's one step too far. He's not good at school bureaucracy, and lots of the correspondence and letters in the Bach Reader, the main documentary source for all information about Bach, is basically Bach complaining about all his duties and everything he has to do, and that the job is impossible. Rather like many a middle-aged man complaining, this job's impossible, and nobody, only I can do it, and nobody understands me. Which I'm very familiar.
One of the surprising things was that Bach wasn't the first choice for the position.
Bach wasn't first choice; he was third choice. Telemann was the first choice, George Telemann, who was in Dresden and Hamburg. Then there was a second candidate, and Bach had to do this audition cantata, two audition cantatas, which are very, very beautiful. I think they're 22 and 23, cantatas 22 and 23. And in fact, I went to a concert given by John Butt and the Dunedin Consort, where they did music by all three. And at the end of the concert, they did a vote for whether Bach should have got the job, and lots of people voted against Bach, which is rather an amazing thing, because I love Cantata 20. Jesus took the 12 disciples in under his name.
Thank you.
I absolutely love that cantata. It just goes to show that longevity and reputation can live beyond the grave.
In your novel, Bach becomes envious when he learns that another composer, George Philipp Telemann, was not only offered the job ahead of him, but was offered a higher salary for the position. And money is a preoccupation of his, as are professional rivalries. Was that the case for the real-life Bach?
Oh, absolutely, yes. I mean, Telemann was offered 1,000 groschen a year, and Bach was only offered about 100. I mean, Telemann was offered virtually 10 times the salary. I mean, it's absolutely ludicrous. There is a lot of preoccupation with money, and I think that what Bach wanted to do was supplement his income. I mean, he's got so many children as well. But he's moved from Curtin as a court composer, playing secular music with his wife as a very well-paid, the best-paid soprano, even though she was only 21, to a religious community where his wife can't actually sing in church, can't earn money performing. And so he's very concerned to earn money from the special services, by which we mean birth, marriage and death, particularly funerals. And there's a famous letter where Bach complains that he's down 100 thaler a year, which is the equivalent of about $10,000, because not enough people have died. There haven't been enough funerals because it's been a very mild winter. So he is capable of complaining, hopefully with a bit of a tongue in a cheek, but that's often the condition of any writer, musician, artist, that we don't feel we're, I mean, obviously not on this show, Eleanor, but we often feel we're not being given enough respect, you know, and that not, people aren't taking us seriously. And we get very, very rivalrous with other people. And Bach, even though utter genius, possibly the greatest musician who's ever lived, still feels that too.
Now, Bach came to Leipzig with his second wife, Anna Magdalena, and his large blended family, including his late wife's sister and many children from his two marriages. It's a lively household. And then early on in your novel, the Bachs add yet another child to the mix. This is the story's narrator. This is your fiction, but it's a schoolboy named Stefan who comes to live with them. Could you read a passage from the book? This is in the voice of Stefan.
Yes, of course. It was a place without privacy and a world without secrets. Conversation was seldom guarded. If children were mature enough to understand, then they were old enough to know. Even if it was intimate information, such as the nature of the cantor's marriage, the couple's opinions about friends, neighbours, teachers and colleagues, their attitudes to money, saving and spending, or their health, work and faith. People expected to be overheard and couldn't be precious about what anyone else knew or thought. None of us could keep anything to ourselves for long. There were 4 children from the cantor's marriage to his wife who had died. 17-year-old Katerina was at the table cutting her father's quills from goose feathers. 15-year-old Friedemann was playing his violin. 12-year-old Emmanuel was still in lessons, and 11-year-old Bernard was trying out something on the harpsichord. Then, born to the cantor and Anna Magdalena, were 3-year-old Etta, who was running down the corridors with her hoop and ball, 2-year-old Gottfried Heinrich, 1-year-old Christian Gottlieb, and the baby Lieschen, who had arrived just before Easter and who was crying out to be fed. You could hardly move without getting in another person's way. The home ran to a timetable that was as strict as that of the school. Each member of the family took turns to practice on the harpsichord. There was almost no time in the day when it remained silent. To be doing nothing, to rest or remain unoccupied, was a sin. Throughout the house, singing was as familiar as speech. Anna Magdalena sang folk tunes from her childhood about the lark and the raven, the old woodturner, the maid and the river, the false soldier, the lonely swan. There were drinking songs, old hymns and lullabies, sometimes without words at all. Little Etta joined in as she held Gottfried's hand, and Heinrich crawled from room to room. Tunes were repeated, played upon, converted and reworked. We give music to any text that needs it, the cantor said. That is the joy of it, Monsieur Silberman. A simple act of transposition, major to minor, or a change of key, and everything is different. It is like the bounty of God's grace, always revealing itself in different ways.
James Runcie reading from his new novel, The Great Passion. In total, Bach fathered an astounding 20 children. In your novel, Anna Magdalena jokes, "I sometimes think my husband expects me to give birth to an entire orchestra." What do we know about him as a father?
Well, we know that the secret, I think, to domestic harmony was musical harmony, and he thought that everyone should play together. He wrote a famous letter about he's got enough to form both an instrumental and a vocal ensemble from his own family. We know he was dedicated. We know that he was demanding. We know that he was affectionate. We know that one of his children was not necessarily as advanced as the others, and he would take special care of him. We know that he wrote enormous recommendations for his children, and we know that he was quite rivalrous with his most brilliant musical son, Carl Philipp Emanuel, who other people have written about going to work with Frederick the Great and maybe setting Bach the great challenge of an 8-part fugue, the musical offering. So we know that, and we know that he was a pillar of the community. My way of imagining him is as this family man in a house that's never, in which it's very hard to be alone, apart from when you're in your study composing music. And part of that is living in a house where my father was a priest and my mother was a piano teacher, people would come to the house all the time. So there was no privacy. And I think fatherhood, and I'm the father of two daughters, you know, you really think about what that is and what that means. Do you want your children to be like you or not for a start off? Do you want them to do the same kind of career or do something different? Do you want your children to be friends or do you want them to be independent people in their own right? Well, the answer is both. And I think Bach's conflicted about all of that, but of course he has 20 children, 11 of whom died before he did. So it's an extraordinary world in which, you know, death is ever present. So death, hope, birth, it's incredibly visceral as a life.
As we heard in the passage you read there, there's hardly a moment when someone isn't practicing an instrument. As Stefan, the narrator, sees it, to be doing nothing, to rest or remain unoccupied, was a sin. The idea of work as moral virtue, it comes up a lot in your book. Can you talk about that?
I think you're referring to Protestantism, Eleanor.
could be.
the work ethic. Yes, well, of course, in my family, my mother, I think, regarded reading a book as some kind of leisure activity that wasn't really work. You had to be seen to be working. Also, you can't be seen to be enjoying yourself too much. I mean, that is all part of it, of course. You have to actually be serious about the business of living. You know, that is, I think, the thing. I think, by the way, Bach was perfectly capable of laughter and joy, and there's some very lovely secular pieces, and there's a famous poem he wrote about the joy of smoking his pipe. So it wasn't all labour, but I think that your duty as a Christian pilgrim on this earth was not to waste your time, not to waste the opportunity to be alive, because of course you will be judged on the way that you have lived your life. Many people are very estranged from that concept, but in the 17th and 18th century, the way you lived on this temporal earth was the way you would live for eternity. And so this earth, this life, is a testing ground. And if you like, your life is one long exam, and you better not fail it. Rather an alarming thought, don't you think?
James Runcie, we'll come back to Bach and his household, but I want to hear a little bit more about your own family. As you mentioned, your father, Robert Runcie, was an Anglican priest. When you were around 21, he became the Archbishop of Canterbury, second only to the Queen in the Church of England. Growing up in a vicarage in the 1960s and 70s, apart from the fact that there was so much going on in the household, what was it like for you?
It was quite weird, I have to say, but of course I didn't think it was weird, but it was a little village, just a few hundred people outside Oxford, and death came to the door. People would knock on the door, and I remember when I was 6 years old, a woman came to the door and said, where's your father? And I said, he's out. And she said, Kevin Dimmock's been knocked off his motorbike. He's got internal bleeding. He won't last the night. Can you tell your father that? I said, yes, I can. She said, no, I want you to repeat it. I want you to repeat, Kevin Dimmock's been knocked off his motorbike. He's got internal bleeding. He won't last the night. He needs to get to the hospital. And so when I was a six-year-old boy, you kind of remember that. And there was a woman, a secretary, who came and her husband had left her. And she threw this sort of massive wobbly. And I was, as she has every right to do, but I was kind of eight and just thought, gosh, this is weird. But to me, it became normal to have people's emotions very displayed in quite a raw way. And it was a world where birth, love, death, the passage of time, the rituals of everyday life were very observed and very intense. And they were not... There wasn't much small talk. I mean, there was small talk because we watched telly and football and that kind of thing. But generally, there was quite a lot of music, love and death. Yeah, normal life, but somehow strangely intensified and made public. And then, of course, when my father became more famous and therefore was more responsible, and we were part of a society which, you know, was very fractured in the 1980s, then there was...
But even as a kid in a small village, I imagine it's the kind of place where everyone knows the clergyman's family. What were there pressures or high expectations on you?
Oh, high expectations to behave well, yes, of course. And generally, clergy children get into terrible trouble because they're either rebel very badly and they go totally off the rails, or they're cowed and become... They try to live up to their father's reputation, and there's a big pressure to be good, and my father's phrase, not let the side down. So you have to not let the side down, you have to be as good as you can be. And obviously there are moments where you think, actually, I'm not going to do that, I'm going to rebel here.
What effect do you think it had on you?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, enormous. It makes you competitive because you see your father being well-loved and being a showman. That's another thing about the priesthood that is often quite weird. Now, of course, what's going to happen now is that priests are going to say, we're not showmen. They're going to write in and send you emails saying, what does he mean? We're not showmen. We're just doing God's work. And they are, of course, they are. But there is a very, I think, quite a thin line between theatre and the clergy. There's a theatricality to preaching, making a speech, dressing up, costumes. And so, you know, in a way, showbiz, which I laughably think I'm part of, is the secular version of being a priest, in the sense that you want to be at your best and bring out the best in other people. The thing is, it's what you feel responsible for other people's happiness. You feel a responsibility to entertain. And that's quite confusing. I don't complain about it. I'm not complaining. I'm just saying that's how it is. I did have a therapist for a short time who said to me, have you ever thought of going into a room and saying nothing? Have you ever thought of going into a room and just sort of sitting in a corner? And I said, no, God, don't be stupid. Of course not. It's my responsibility to kind of make the party go and make sure people are happy and be interested in other people, be curious, check everyone's all right. That's my job. He said, well, it isn't really your job, is it? I mean, no one's asking you to do that. And I said, but I'm asking myself, or I think I have to honour my father or something like that. Anyway, thousands of pounds later, I came to some kind of reconciliation. I realise this is quite confessional. I wasn't intending to go here, Eleanor.
Well, as you mentioned, your mother, Rosalind Runcie, was a concert pianist, and I read that she had a bit of a rebellious streak. In what
yes.
sense?
She did not want to be regarded as some kind of second fiddle, as some kind of merely a wife or not a woman in her own right. She was an early feminist, and it was quite dispiriting to go into parties or rooms where everyone wanted to speak to my dad or her husband. They only wanted to speak to him. So if they ended up with you, they made it very clear you were second best. And my mother didn't want to go to parties where she was considered second best. She just got fed up with it. So she ended up not going. She didn't go to lots of these things. I mean, I famously went to a dinner party where at 9 o'clock, which is quite early, she said, "I'm going home to watch Monty Python." Which is quite rude. But, you know, she'd had enough. And that was it. And, I mean, you could argue that was... And in fact, my father's sister complained and said, you know, you're not doing your duty, you're not doing your job. But I think she thought that her job was to be a more interesting, independent woman. It was weird because of the undertow of post-war society and Victorian values still around. You know, it wasn't a fully modern... Despite the 60s, of course, the village life in the Church of England lagged a bit behind. And so expectations were that you would preserve values that were being changed.
As you were saying, your mother and sister would sing in the choir, and your family would attend a performance of Bach's St. Matthew Passion every Easter. For those who aren't familiar with it, can you describe the Passion, what story it tells?
The St. Matthew Passion is two chapters of St. Matthew's Gospel at Easter that tells the story of Christ's arrival in Jerusalem, his arrest, trial, and death. Basically, there is a verse, an announcement, so a description of what's happening. Then there's recitative that explains why it's important. And then there's an aria by a soprano, alto, tenor, or bass that talks about what it means. And then there's a summary chorale, which everyone joins in, which choirs join in, two choirs join in to sing about what it means to the story and how it's important personally to them. And what's extraordinary about it is it's a mixture of the utterly intimate, sorrowful, grief-ridden text about the death, the murder of Jesus, and what that means to everyone involved. And then out of that intimacy and out of that grief becomes this general magnificence of shared emotion, which builds towards the summary of the grief for all people and looks forward to the death of death, which is the resurrection. It's 4 hours long. It's in two parts with two orchestras and two choirs. And when it was first performed, there would be a sermon in the middle. When I say it's 4 hours, it can be 3.5, depending on how fast the conductor takes it. It's the most intense piece of music about love and grief there is, in my view. People listening would say, hang on a minute, Mozart's Requiem. But for me, it is the most profound examination of what it is to live, love, lose, and try to find hope, try to find beauty in grief. To quote the prophet Isaiah, to turn ashes into beauty, to make beauty for ashes. That's what it's about.
Let's hear the opening chorus of St. Matthew Passion.
Thank you.
That's the Monteverdi Choir, conducted by John Elliott Gardner, recorded in 1988. We hear the alternation there between the two choirs, not quite, but a call and response style. There's a conversation unfolding. Can you say what it's about?
It's about the Old and New Testament coming together. It's about two kind of Greek choruses coming together. It's antiphonal singing. What's extraordinary is if you go to Leipzig, there are two organ lofts, so people talk and sing across the space. So it's about dialogue, and it's about what's going on. Look, see, what's going on. So it's people observing. See him. Who? Who's there? What's going on? It's a kind of crowd scene, and yet it's also about, this is really important. My God, pay attention, because this is somebody. This is the saviour of mankind who's about to be crucified. It's a call to attention from a crowd that can be both observers and participants. It's exactly the same as the Greek chorus. They can watch and they can be part of it. And that's its beauty and its genius and its grandeur. And the other strange tension in it is that it's a funeral tombo. It's a funeral pace, but it's also a dance. So it's a dance of death. So it's a dance rhythm, but it's a funeral subject. So everything about it is counterpoint. It's two choirs, two orchestras, funeral dance. It's the most extraordinary opening. And it can be 8 minutes long and it can be 6 minutes long, depending on how long people take it. But it is the biggest, grandest announcement in any oratorio.
James Runcie, to understand how Bach came to write the Matthew Passion, can you talk briefly about his upbringing and the world that shaped him as a musician?
Well, Bach comes from a musical family, and all his relations are musicians. Actually, originally, you know, 150 years before, they're Hungarian bakers. He's orphaned, by the way. His parents die when he's 9 and 10. He is orphaned and goes to live with his brother, who's an organist. And he's trained as an organist, and he also plays the viola. And he comes from this massive musical family who needs to earn money. They're not educated in that traditional sense. So Bach doesn't go to university. One of the reasons he goes to Leipzig is to get his children into university. The job comes with automatic places for his children at the university, and he wants to give his children the education he never had. His musical education is paramount, as is his religious education and his classical education in Latin and theology. But it's all of a piece that theology and music, of course, religion is a sort of science at this time. You know, it is the whole way in which you think of the meaning of life.
As you say, both his parents died when he was a child. Two of his siblings also died later, his first wife, many of his own children. As you put it, death was familiar and daily and constant for Bach. In your novel, you imagine that he confronts his grief through his music. And I know this is speculative, but what connection might there be between the losses in his own life and a work such as St. Matthew Passion?
Well, death is the great confusion and the great difficulty. And religion is either the great salvation or the great vanity. That we are special, that somehow we will live again, that there is a life beyond this that animals, sparrows, don't know. I think Bach found death was a natural part of life, and writing his music must be about addressing the nature of what it is to be human. It's quite important that he also is capable of writing the most enormous, celebratory, joyous music, the Brandenburg Concertos, some of the beautiful piano music or keyboard music. that he is capable of enormous joy and celebration. I love it when the trumpets come into Bach. Of course, there are no trumpets in the St. Matthew Passion. He's provided with two trumpeters. He doesn't use them because there's no joy in the St. Matthew Passion. Although there is beauty, there's no joy. There's a difference.
He goes to the oboists.
He goes to the oboists. He goes to a special oboist, the oboe da caccia player. There's a special oboe which he loves. And he's writing for specific musicians, I think, in certain passages. That is the most beautiful oboe music. I mean, his job is to explain and make clear the biblical story to people who don't necessarily read books, to people who might be denied the opportunity to know about it. And his job is to make what the preachers are saying beautiful. Preachers will give you fact and warning and advice and instruction about how to live a better, more moral life. Bach will give you inspiration and the idea of the fact that that life may be more beautiful.
Hi, I'm Caitlin Prest, and I am here in your ear to tell you about a very incredible new show called Asking for It. Asking for It is a darkly comedic series that follows a queer femme singer whose history of violence finds her no matter how many times she runs away. It has an original soundtrack, and it'll make you laugh, cry, and feel a little bit less alone. Asking for It. Subscribe now.
James Runcie, one side of Bach that you bring out is the fact that he has such a short fuse, that he's an intense,
yes,
passionate man who has a tendency to lose his temper. You're right, when he was 20, he got into a sword fight with a fellow musician, calling him a prick of a bassoonist. He apparently also once yelled at a keyboard player. I love this, I quote it, because he says, it's not difficult, just hit the right notes at the right time and the instrument will play itself. What do you understand about this side of him?
Well, I absolutely know about this from performers and teachers and musicians. And one of the inspirations for this was a violinist I heard, Adrian Chandler, he's called, who runs Serenissima, this Baroque chamber orchestra. And I saw him rehearse once an opera, and he stopped the whole orchestra and said, there are three rules. One, watch me. Two, watch me. Three, watch me. Now get on with it. Get this right. I can't understand why you can't get this right. And I thought, oh gosh, that's probably what Bach was like. You know, obviously when you're rehearsing, there's a short time. There's a deadline. I mean, in this Bach case, Good Friday, you know, April the 7th, 1727. He's got to get it right by then. That's it. That is performance date. One performance only. And all tension in rehearsal rooms about running out of time and about not getting it right or people not being up to job, and the feeling that the performance is going to be an absolute disaster, it's going to be a total catastrophe from which you'll never recover and you'll never work again. So I can see that that is quite a big thing that Bach might have thought. And there are cases of him, you know, there are reports of him throwing off his wig in a temper in a rehearsal room, as well as what you refer to, the calling a young colleague a prick of a bassoonist. And he definitely did have a temper, and that is recorded. But I think that's all part of the creative process. That is all part of what creativity is about, you know. And people do get very, very tense and het up when it's about performance.
Well, one person who is able to calm him down is his wife, Anna Magdalena. I have a clip from your BBC radio play, also called The Great Passion. And in this scene, Bach and Lena, who he calls Magdalena, are discussing rehearsals for the upcoming performance of The Passion.
Come to bed.
Why did you send that man over to me?
I wanted him to understand what you were up to. Be impressed.
He may like to find out what we're doing, but now he's seen the mess we're in, he'll think it's all a failure.
We don't know that.
You can't let the paymasters into rehearsals too soon. Most of them form their opinion straight away. If they come early and it isn't right and they don't like it, then you have to work so much harder to change their mind.
Don't be angry.
I can't help it. Now I'm angry with myself.
It's always like this.
To begin is easy, to persist is art, I know.
But I can never quite predict when you're going to lose your temper. Otherwise, I would stop you.
It's difficult not to feel that people are undermining me. I know I lose my temper with the wrong people at the wrong time. As long as it doesn't happen with you.
Perhaps they are frightened of letting you down.
They just have to work harder. But I can't tell them that now I've lost my temper with them, and that makes me even more angry.
You're angry that you can't be angry?
Yes, now I'll have to be kind to them, and that means they won't take my instructions seriously. They might even think they're performing capably.
You remember what it is like, my darling, after a rehearsal when things have not gone well? You try and try, but your playing doesn't get any better. You just have to leave it alone for a while. The yeast has to rise for the bread to bake. Think of your mother.
Sometimes those children are as flat as a pancake.
Come to bed.
I should work.
Save it for the morning.
My head is full of noise. I keep dreaming that it's all going wrong and that the whole piece is one long cacophony and that we will never get it right. And then sometimes I stop hearing it altogether. I cannot imagine it at all and I think I'm going mad. We have so little time.
There is always next year.
It needs to be right this year, not next. Do you think it's all right? The piece, I mean.
You always ask that question, and yet you know it is. You shouldn't have doubts. They slow you down.
I want you to be proud of me, Lena.
Simon Russell Beale and Melody Grove in James Runce's The Great Passion. They have a tender relationship, as you imagine it. Why is Anna Magdalena so important to the story you're telling?
Well, this is quite personal and quite difficult, but I'll go here, Eleanor. The reason she's important and personal, the easy answer, is she's who he comes home to at the end of the day. She's whom he shares everything with. And I wanted the intimate personal stuff to be part of it. But of course, this is the difficult bit. It's also about the way I've lived with my wife, and she's not alive anymore. She was the inspiration to everything I did, and we were married 35 years, and she was that. And it's another thing I could write about, which is about some, you know, angry, raving man coming home going, nobody understands me. And Marilyn would say all those kind of Anna Magdalena things. And so it was a way of personalising it. And also, I thought, you know, it's very important to have him as a married man and to have him as a father and not just to have him only as, just like we were talking earlier about my mother. She's more than a bishop's wife or an archbishop's wife or a clergyman's. She was a woman in her own right. I realise, by the way, Eleanor, that we've gone from my wife to my mother in the same paragraph, which obviously Freudians would find quite interesting, but let's not go there.
I won't tell your therapist if you're still speaking. <Okay. laughs>
But yes, I think that it's really important to have that emotional, intimate story, because we all live a balance of life between the private and the public. And the public makes the private more intense, and the private makes the public more intense.
And you've written a memoir, a book about your wife, separate from this.
I have, yes. Novel. It's coming out later this year. It's called Tell Me Good Things. And I've tried to make it about her rather than about me. And I'm both a bit scared of it and pleased I've done it, because I think I have to honour her. And I think I also have to express gratitude, because life isn't always just about all the, you know, difficult things that happen, or, you know, Bach, I keep saying Bach has joy in it too, and I think that there has to be thankfulness as part of life. So it's weird to have two books coming out in the same year, but they are companion pieces in a way, in a bizarre way.
But what struck me also was in The Great Passion, there are three characters who lose their wives in the course of the story, too.
I know. Well, yeah, it's It's funny that. I mean, there's this thing called anticipatory grief. I wrote this series of novels, Grantchester, and in the last Grantchester book, spoiler alert, Sidney Chambers' wife dies. And my daughter, my youngest daughter, said, I hope you're not proud of this. I hope you're not expecting praise. Because she was cross. Both daughters were cross. But, you know, you're right to address your fears. And obviously she was, Marilyn, my wife, was the most amazing person, and so our loss is immense. And I was trying to imagine what life would be like without her. Well, now I know, not great is the answer, but you just try to write in order to make it better, in order to head off the grief that will come. And of course, it doesn't do any of that, but it sort of vaguely helps. But like all of our expectations and fears, when they come, they're very different to how we imagined them. So you wondered why you practiced it, but that is, of course, in the Christian tradition, you do practice grief and you expect it, and that's what priests teach, and that's what Bach would have done. I think anyone listening to this is going to need a stiff drink afterwards, by the way. So it's just, I don't know why we're going into this, but there is no other subject, really. I mean, obviously there are other things in life, but the eternal verities are what obsess me, and that's what I think I need to, what I've found myself addressing. And maybe that's what being a son of a priest is all about.
Well, I think in writing a book about a man writing the St. Matthew Passion, then you're unavoidably going to touch on these subjects. And as we've been discussing, the Passion was this huge undertaking, two choirs, two orchestras. Bach brought in the German poet librettist Christian Friedrich Henrici, known by his pen name Picander, because he was so ambitious for it. He wanted to quote your novel. He said it was time to make an impact, to make his work dramatic without being operatic. Do you understand why they were so ambitious?
Yes, partly because there's a routine to religious services, and everyone knows the story and everyone goes through the story. And what they want to do is wake people up. And actually, there are a few cantatas of Bach's that begin with kind of wake up, sleepers wake, pay attention, listen to this. And they wanted to reinvent and recreate the story. And the way to do that is to make people think that Christ has just arrived in Leipzig in 1727. Would they still crucify him? What would you do? I mean, that classic question, what would you do if you were there? Would you have defended him? Or would you have crucified him? And they want to make it immediate, visceral, emotional, and make the orchestral piece, the musical piece, the oratorio piece, an act of faith in itself, to make it a kind of prayer.
On April 11th, 1727, the St. Matthew Passion was performed for the first time in St. Thomas's Church in Leipzig, Germany. What was the response?
We don't fully know what the response was. We know that it was repeated four or five times and alternated with the St. John Passion. There's a lost St. Mark Passion, and there would presumably at one point been an attempt at a St. Luke Passion, so all four Gospels would have been set to music. We do know, however, that Anna Magdalena referred to it as the Great Passion, i.e. his big Passion piece. And we do know that it was the only piece of music he made an absolute fair copy of, with the ink in brown and Christ's words in red. So it is the absolute thing that he wanted to be remembered for. Other people think the Mass in B minor is his great creation. There's an argument that it was never heard in its entirety. It was only heard in bits. But the St. Matthew Passion is the most complete manifestation of Bach's faith in music.
The St. Matthew Passion was performed several times during Bach's life, but after his death in 1750, like most of his compositions, it was forgotten. What happened? How is Bach remembered after his death, and how did it get rediscovered?
Bach was considered old-fashioned, and so his music, although the keyboard music was taught, obviously Bach did not really know the piano. He knew the fortepiano, but the piano was not really advanced. So this was old-fashioned harpsichord music, old-fashioned religious oratorios, and life and music moved on until Mendelssohn rediscovered the St. Matthew Passion in, I think, 1827, and did a performance of it. And everyone went, hang on, this is rather amazing. So he died in 1750. So his music was lost for, let's say, 77 years. And lots of the manuscripts were dispersed. Friedemann had some, his eldest son Friedemann had some. Carl Philipp Emanuel was pursuing his own career. But he seemed to belong to another era. And it required a sort of a different sensibility or for time to pass. Now, I think, there's why people love Bach's music is partly because it is so ordered and so beautiful. And I sometimes think the more disordered our lives become, the more we long for the order of Bach. We long for a sense of structure, a sense of reassurance. Music is as if it's been created before we were born and will live on after we've died. There's a sort of feeling of eternity. There's a feeling it could go on forever. He's a great believer in variation, and you have a theme and you vary it and you play upon it. And it seems to be there's inexhaustible variety, which is a simile for life itself, really, that you may live your life, but you can have endless variations upon it. And he seems to strike a particularly modern chord where he can go from the complex to the minimalist. So we have a taste in society now for minimalism and for whiteness and for cleanliness and for purity and for a few clear things on a table. And Bach has that interior minimalist aesthetic, but also it's very, very complicated at the same time. So it's endlessly revealing itself behind the clean presentation.
James Runcie, we were talking earlier about your father, Robert Runcie, the former Archbishop of Canterbury, who was, in part, the inspiration for your very successful series of novels, The Grantchester Mysteries, which became a popular television drama, now in its seventh season. Set in post-war Britain, the central character, Sidney Chambers, is an Anglican priest turned amateur sleuth. You said he both is and isn't your father. It's obviously the isn't part in the amateur sleuth department, but after you wrote six in the series, during which there are some allusions to Sidney's backstory, especially his experience in the Second World War, you produced a seventh and, as I understand, final book of the series, a prequel called The Road to Grantchester. Why did you want to end things by going back to the beginning?
Because I wanted to think about the route to faith and why somebody believes in the middle of war, in the middle of the Second World War. And I wanted to kind of explain how it had happened. And I wanted to do a series about post-war Britain with some kind of moral force behind it. I was rather struck by the idea that in Agatha Christie adaptations, or everyone seems to recover from deaths quite quickly. There's no emotional undertow. It's all about plot rather than meaning. And I want to do meaning rather than plot. I'm not ruling out writing a final book, because I think it might be nice to round off one element, which is Sydney's love life and Sydney's family, and there's unresolved issues.
Is he going to get together with Amanda now?
Well, of course he is.
Is that why you killed off his wife?
Yes, of course he's going to end up with Amanda. Of course he's going to. Yes. Yes, of course. Of course. That's the whole point. And it's not why I killed off the wife, but it's, yeah, of course he's, yes. So it starts off with this massive, unresolved sexual tension with Amanda. And then 8 books later, it's similar to Love in the Time of Cholera by Marquez, as he desperately dragging in a high-level reference point. It's similar to that. So, yeah, the idea is that after 60 years, he might end up finally, after all their problems and all Amanda's terrible relationships, they will end up together. They have to, and that is finally, eventually, and at last, what we know in the trade as a happy ending. So that's a bit of a spoiler alert, isn't it? Maybe I don't even need to write it.
But everyone looks forward to it. Everyone looks forward to it, so it doesn't matter.
I know.
It's that kind of gratification.
Yes.
But the issue that you do raise in this novel is about how you find faith in the context of war. I mean, like, how does a man emerge from that with his faith intact, witnessing the death of so many of his comrades?
Yes. There are many choices. My grandfather on my mother's side stood up in the First World War and said, there is no God. There cannot be God to allow this. There cannot be God. My father thought, how can life be better than this? How can there be redemption? How can there be some kind of hope? How can we prevent this ever happening again? And those are two ways of looking at it. And some people felt something I've never felt, which is what I wanted to talk about in The Road to Grantchester, what they call a flood of grace. And they wanted to have this flood of grace. And so I think that that's a mission to make life better, a mission to be kinder, more loving, more tolerant, more compassionate, to create a better society. And I've been rather obsessed with this idea that in my lifetime, I was brought up to believe, how can we build a better society? And I now seem to live in a world which is more a case of, how can I be famous, or how can I succeed? So we've changed pronouns from we to I. And I think that is problematic and not a good thing.
It's an absolute delight to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Oh, sorry, Eleanor, sorry. I realise it's been incredibly serious. I can be jokey and funny too, but these are serious issues, and so we have to address them. And thank you for being so incredibly thoughtful and wonderful in your questions and in your compassion and in your sharing.
Thank you. Thank you so much. James Runcie at his home near St. Andrews, Scotland in 2022. His novel, The Great Passion, is available in paperback. The Grantchester Mystery Series can be found as ebooks as well as paperback, and the TV adaptations on streaming platforms, and a 9th season was announced last summer. Runcie's most recent book is his memoir, Tell Me Good Things, on love, death, and marriage. Today's show was produced by Katie Swales, with thanks to Olivia Pascarelli. The senior producer is Sandra Rabinovich. You can also hear Writers and Company on our website. Just go to cbc.ca/writersandcompany. I'm Eleanor Wachtel. Next week, novelist and short story writer Anita Desai. From India to England and then to the U.S., her award-winning career spans 3 continents and 50 years. That's next week. I hope you'll join me.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.